Well, look, see, there's an abominable snowman in the supermarket. And apparently the housewives have never seen anything like that before. Here, the housewives complaining to the manager.
Oh,
get that snow thing out of this store. Abominable snowman in the market. That's right, you heard me right, Kay. And the housewives, they all remark, it looks like a dirty marshmallow with fangs. Well, there's a vulnerable snowman in the market. Now he's down by the peas and carrot. A vulnerable snowman in the market, and they cannot chase him away. What you say? Vulnerable snowman in the market. All right. Oh, vulnerable snowman in the market. Oh my.
That's Jonathan Richmond behind us now, bomb snowman on the market. We heard Corpus doing Let Me Out of Here. Sister Irene O'Connor with Fire. Wet Tuna did Rural Glam Senor Quien. I just found that. It's brand new, actually. He just put it up on YouTube a month ago. And that's what I went to YouTube looking for. Is there a synth cover of In the Court of the Crimson King? There it comes. And Automatic before that, Is It Now, from last year's Is It Now. We heard the Sorcerers doing Ancestral Machines. We heard the Stylistics doing It's Too Late.
That's right.
Now I gotta go. I hope you have a great evening, everybody. Stay tuned. Mark Hurst's Tectonic is coming right up. I'll see you next week at the Marathon. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Okay, bye.
Hey everybody, welcome to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks for joining. I have an announcement, good news, and that is that today marks a milestone. This is the 400th episode of Tectonic. I started the show on September 11, 2017. That was the first episode, and the show's been going every week since. Today is episode 400. Now, some people looking through the archives may count up all the shows and say, well, actually, this is the, 408th episode or something like that. And that's because there have been a few guest-hosted episodes along the way. So when I say 400, I'm counting only the episodes I have hosted. Anyway, we're at 400 episodes. Very excited. It's about 8.5 years now, and I guess the question is, how do you mark this kind of moment? And after some thought, what I've done is I've put together something special for you, which is a hand-picked selection of excerpts from some of the interviews along the way. And since we're at episode 400, I've tried to do something sort of cheeky, which is that I've chosen two episodes from each of the hundreds. That is to say, a pair of shows from the episodes under 100, a pair in the hundreds, a pair in the 200s, and then a pair in the 300s. So it should be 8 excerpts altogether, if I have time to get through all 8. We'll see. And to make it extra cool, I thought, anyway, it was cool. Each pair of excerpts includes the inaugural episode of that 100, if that makes sense. So we're going to get audio from episode 300 and episode 200 and episode 100. And for the first time ever, something I have never done on this show, I'm going to play you some audio from the very first Tectonic episode, episode number 1. And I hope you enjoy it. We'll get to that in a minute. I will give you the episode numbers and dates as we go along, so you'll have some sense of where we are in the development of the show. But what I'd like you to listen for are two things. First, what has changed, because the world was a different place in 2017 when the show started. You'll hear in these clips that we're encountering some now familiar issues pretty early on. Like, for example, automated license plate readers we covered pretty early on. And issues like that have really spread since then. And it feels like a much, a much more tech-pervasive society than it was in 2017. And, of course, 2017 was pre-ChatGPT and pre-generative AI, all that AI stuff. There was some AI back then, but not to the extreme and dangerous levels of hype that we're experiencing now. And yet, even in those pre-ChatGPT days, there were plenty of things to talk about. So anyway, listen along the way for what's changed, but also listen for what has stayed the same. You'll hear, for example, that in the very first episode, I was talking about surveillance from Amazon Alexa. And that's how the show started. You'll hear that in the clip I'm going to play for you. So I've tried over the years for the show to maintain a focus on the abuses of Silicon Valley and, on the positive side, what we can do about it or what some alternative approaches are. And I hope that comes across in these excerpts. Before I start us off with the excerpt from episode 1, I want to say that all of these shows I'm going to play for you are available in the online archive, and you can find them all linked for your convenience from the episode page for today's show. Go to the Tectonic website to get to that. That's tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and find the page for episode 400. And that's how we're going to celebrate making it to 400. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, enough prologue. Let's get started. Let's start with a clip from episode number 1. This was September 11th, 2017, and my guest was Scott Heiferman, founder of Meetup.com, and we were, when I recorded that interview a little bit before September 11th, we were sitting in what at the time were the Meetup offices. Meetup since then has been sold off, and I'm not totally sure who owns it now. Another one of those changes in the tech industry. But at the time, Meetup, I found, was doing something interesting in that it was encouraging people to get off their devices and, in fact, get together in person. And so Scott and I talked about how the internet was coming to all sorts of devices back in 2017. It wasn't just people sitting in front of a screen of a laptop or a desktop computer. And so as we're talking about this variety of devices back then, that opened up this memorable exchange about Amazon Alexa. And I'm going to play you this excerpt now from episode one of Tectonic with my guest, Scott Heiferman. Here it is.
It's not like the internet is not like, oh, you're sitting in front of a computer anymore. So, in fact, you know, when my three-year-old boy calls out in the living room, you know, Alexa, what's the weather? And by the way, just saying Alexa, you know, on a podcast or a radio show means that it's going to screw up people's living rooms or wherever right now.
What, just saying Alexa like that?
Yeah.
Alexa.
Alexa, order me food. So when my son just calls out like, Alexa, what's the weather? You know, is he on the internet? Like, what does that mean? I mean, and I know you're also interested in the notion of if audio of my living room is being streamed to an Amazon server somewhere 24/7. Does that mean I'm on the internet or off the internet? I don't know. So we're not trying to get too philosophical or analytical about that notion. But yeah, we want to bring people together.
Let's talk about Alexa. Run by me again. What happened at your breakfast table?
Oh yeah, it's just that I found myself inspired one day to tell my kids. I have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. Who I brought the Alexa into my home because the goal was to make it so that I'm less dependent on the phone. You know, my goal is to like not use my phone when I'm with my kids, which I don't usually keep that promise to myself. But if I can have something that lets me like if I want to play a song or know the weather or whatever, like I don't want to reach for my phone. I'd like to just call it out. Anyways, you know, my kids have an interesting relationship with Alexa. And it's a member of the household in the sense that, you know, any electronic device or the chair is. But yet I felt compelled to tell my kids that Alexa doesn't love you. And it stirred a bunch of odd reactions. And then, you know, it kind of leads to the questions of, well, why does my 3-year-old son's stuffed animal, monkey, you know, we like to think that there's a love between the stuffed animal and the kid, but I feel it's very important that they understand that there ain't no love between Alexa and them. And I always correct them when they refer to Alexa as a she. I say, no, it's it. And this just happened actually yesterday. You know, they said, oh, Alexa, you know, she didn't hear me. I said, no, it didn't hear you. I don't, you know, I can't explain exactly why I'm like so adamant about this point, but yeah, I mean, I guess as time goes on, you know, the machines will mimic living things more and more. It's just natural or unnatural, but that's that critical piece of saying like, you know, like coming to grips with the fact that it's shocking to ever hear something doesn't love you. Like, how could you ever say something doesn't love you? But no, Alexa does not love you.
And that was Scott Heiferman, founder of Meetup, talking with me on episode one of Tectonic about how, as he put it, Alexa doesn't love you. And I was so struck by that comment that I named the episode with that phrase. You can see it in the Tectonic archives. Alexa doesn't love you. And that was, in a way, one of the founding, I don't know, calls or insights that helped me develop my thinking around this show over the years, that we have we often make a category error when we develop or think we develop relationships with these inanimate devices. And what's worse, it's not like having a stuffed animal that, you know, people have whatever relationship with. You're actually relating to a really damaging, toxic, potentially addictive, harmful system that has been designed in those ways by these growth-at-any-cost companies. Obviously, my critique of these devices has expanded since that first episode, but I was glad to see the germ of that idea was there from the beginning, as well as this warning about big tech surveillance. I mean, from the very get-go. I was warning about that, and now we know so much more about what big tech is up to. All right, so that was episode one. Let's move on to the next episode, and as I said, we're doing pairs of episodes in each of the hundreds. So in the first, well, it's not the first 100, actually, the episodes under 100 is our first pair, so the first 99, I guess. I started with episode one, and we're going to follow up with episode number 7. This was from October 23rd, 2017. And the title of this episode is Phone Robots Will Fight Telemarketers For You, featuring Roger Anderson, founder of Jolly Roger Telephone Company. So this was a really fun interview with lots of fun excerpts that I played of Roger Anderson's service, his Jolly Roger telephone service. The premise is that Roger came up with this early stage chatbot, I guess you could say. He didn't call it that, but in the language you use today, that's probably where I would put it. The idea is that when a telemarketer calls you and you know that it's a telemarketer, you can forward it or somehow conference in this bot that Roger has built. And what the bot does is it listens for the audio from the telemarketer, and whenever there's a gap in the conversation, it just puts in some neutral response, like, yeah. And then every now and then it says something really funny. And the idea, as Roger explained in episode 7, was to waste the telemarketer's time so that it increases the costs for the owners of those telemarketing companies so that telemarketing would become too expensive to pursue and to have a little fun at the same time. So Roger has a way of, if people opt in, of recording these phone calls, or I guess he has a way to allow the users to choose to record their own phone calls and then send to Roger the footage. And so he had some really funny excerpts of actual calls of telemarketers trying to scam someone and the bot coming online. So I'm going to play my favorite. This is called Google Specialist, and it's a telemarketer slash spammer or scammer, I don't know, claiming to be able to raise someone's Google rankings. And so what you're going to hear at the very beginning of this excerpt is two bots talking to each other, and then a human telemarketer comes on, and that's when it really gets amusing. Let's go ahead now and listen to this. Again, it's from episode 7 from October 2017, an excerpt from Roger Anderson's Jolly Roger Telephone Company service. Here it is.
Hello.
Hi, this is Sharon, your local Google specialist. We have a front page...
Wait, is this a real person?
...business like yours, and can guarantee front page placement with unlimited...
Hello?
Your call is being transferred to an account specialist now, and may be monitored and
Hello?
Recorded for quality assurance and training purposes.
Hello?
Thank you for holding. This is Kevin. Can I get started with your first name, please?
Hello?
Yes, hello. How are you doing today?
Yes.
Yes, would you like to have your business listed on the front result page of Google, Yahoo, and Bing?
Yeah.
Great. And I'm speaking to a business owner, correct?
Yeah.
And I didn't get your name.
Okay. So I just woke up from a nap, and I'm kind of groggy. So can you maybe start over a little slower?
I'm sorry. No, I was saying, did you want to have your business listed on the front result page of Google, Yahoo, and Bing?
Uh-huh.
Okay, and are you looking for local or national exposure?
Yeah.
Are you looking for local or national?
Yeah.
Yeah, what? Uh-huh. Which one is it? Local or national?
You know what? I was just finishing up an email, and I missed that part. Can you say that again?
Would you like to have your business listed on the front result page of Google, Yahoo, and Bing?
Right.
Excuse me?
Yes?
Yes?
Oh, hang on. There's a bee on me. Hang on. There's a bee on my arm. Okay. You keep talking, but I'm going to stay quiet because this bee is freaking me out. Go ahead.
Are you looking for local or national exposure?
Uh-huh.
So which one? Local or national?
Yeah.
So local or national?
Yeah. Okay, it's still in my arm. It's just crawling around, but it's not upset, I guess, but I'm afraid to touch it. So you keep talking. I'm just going to stay quiet.
Well, I just need to ask a few questions before we even get into it, and then I'll start talking.
Uh-huh.
So did you want local or national exposure, sir?
Uh-huh. Okay, it's gone. So the bee is gone, and I was not really listening during that part. So when the bee was on my arm, I guess I wasn't really listening to you. Can you start over during the bee thing? What was that?
Are you looking for local or national exposure?
Mm-hmm.
Which one is it? Is there a bear on top of you now?
Uh-huh.
Is there a bear on you now?
Oh, yes! Did you see that? Oh, man, are you watching the game? You're probably not watching the game. I don't even know where you are. McAllister just scored. I think that's it for the game. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead. I'm listening now.
You have a great day, sir, okay? I think you're having too much fun with yourself right now.
Yeah.
Okay, have a great day.
Is there a bear on you? I love the ending to that because the telemarketer was clearly having some fun. Even if he never totally figured out maybe that it was a chatbot, he managed to get amused by the end. That, again, was an excerpt of Tectonic Episode 7 featuring Roger Anderson and the Jolly Roger Telephone Company. And we heard a clip called Google Specialist, in which the bot was talking with a human telemarketer and claiming that there's a bee on his arm and so on. So that was one of the more funny episodes. And I wish I could find more projects like that. If you have any in mind, you can email them to me, mark@tectonic.fm. But let's move on to the next pair of episodes. Again, this is going to be in the hundreds, and we're going to start with episode 100. This is from September 9, 2019. My guest was Arthur Holland Michel, author of a book called Eyes in the Sky. And he was talking about how drones started, how military drones, not so much hobbyist drones, but how military drones started with a project called Gorgon Stare that was developed to look for enemy combatants on the battlefield in Iraq by flying above towns with a drone that was outfitted with an array of cameras that could pick up footage from all over town. And what we talk about in this interview is the development of those drones and also how that turned into the ambient surveillance that we have now, in which government agencies and, of course, big tech companies as well have an ethos of wanting to collect everything on everybody. This was an interesting description of how that got started. So, again, let's hear Arthur Holland Michel from episode 100 on Tectonic. One of the things I found fascinating about the description of Gorgon Stare, or of all of these projects, is the concept of rewinding the tape, so to speak. I mean, it's all digital, but looking backwards from an event, like an explosion, to use that as the basis for understanding and then, as you say, attacking the network. So running the tape backwards and then running it forwards. You don't need to know a whole lot about what's going to happen as long as you've been recording the entire area and continue to record it. That was a good description, I thought, of the power of surveillance. The simple activity of the network combined with the surveillance over time gives the watchers everything they need to know.
Absolutely. And in fact, you use the word activity, and that's a crucial word. They actually use the term activity-based intelligence in these agencies to describe that kind of work, because your adversary in these conflicts doesn't drive around in big platoons with tanks. They don't wear uniforms. They look exactly like any other civilian. And so you suddenly have this tremendous challenge of, as many people will put it, trying to find the needle in the haystack, that one out of 1,000 civilians in the area of conflict who actually is not a civilian, is actually a combatant, someone who's trying to kill you. And so that's why you need to watch everything. In fact, that very same problem gave rise to some of the NSA's really expansive electronic communication collection programs. That is to say, when Keith Alexander, the director of the NSA, said collect it all in regards to communications within a civilian population, he was really talking about trying to get at that exact problem. Because if you don't know who's a civilian and who's a combatant, then you need to collect everything first and then narrow it down from there, just as how with one of these cameras, you have to watch the entire city, most of which is no interest to you, in order to then drill down and find those individuals who you're going after.
You write somewhere in the book that the only way to survive a Gorgon is not to move.
That's right. There was a defense executive who gave a presentation about this technology. And in the presentation, he included that famous quote from Jurassic Park, where Dr. Grant is facing down this T-Rex, and he says, "Don't move, because it won't see us if we don't move." And that is exactly the same principle with Gorgon Stare. The camera's only going to be able to follow you if you get out into public space and drive between your safe house and another safe house. And so really, if you want to do anything about being watched by a Gorgon Stare, you better start digging tunnels, because anytime you're out in the open air, it's going to be watching you.
Okay. I don't know why I'm laughing. This is terrifying.
sometimes your only option is to laugh, because there's no other way to go about it.
Sometimes your only option is to laugh. Well said by Arthur Hall and Michelle. That was episode 100 of Tectonic from September 2019, talking about Arthur's book, Eyes in the Sky, which really gave a good history, clear and informative history of this Gorgon Stare project, which was the project that really kicked off ambient surveillance from the skies, from drones anyway. And that's something that has metastasized. I've done other shows, which I'm not going to play excerpts of right now, but later on in Tectonic's episodes, we covered other places in the world and, in fact, other U.S. cities that have been under surveillance from the skies, notably Baltimore. So that was the beginning of that thread. And that was really... a kind of a grim interview to see that beginning. Let's move on. Let's go on to our second episode from the hundreds, and that is episode 135. This is from May 25, 2020. My guest was Stephen Levy, author of a book called Facebook, The Inside Story. Levy's written many books on tech. This is just one of them, but I was very excited to talk to him about the Facebook volume, because he really got into the details of Facebook's history. The other thing you should know is that we were recording this during COVID lockdown. That was a whole section of Tectonic's history of doing everything remotely, and in some cases broadcasting from my apartment in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. But this one was early on in lockdown, May 2020. And what was interesting about this interview was that it clearly shows, we talked about the part in the book that clearly shows how Mark Zuckerberg developed as an unethical actor. He was never particularly ethical, but there are some key moments you'll hear. And also a bit about the genesis of WhatsApp, which a lot of people don't know. And this is an excerpt that I think about a lot when I talk to people or hear people talking about WhatsApp. So again, this is from episode 135, my interview with Stephen Levy, author of Facebook, The Inside Story. Again and again, Zuckerberg is making decisions that favor Facebook at the expense of its users and users' privacy, the idea of democracy, the lives of people who are affected in Southeast Asia. I mean, we could go on. But one of my main takeaways from the book is that this is a company that's incredibly influential, that has consistently lived by its one value, which is growth at any cost. And your book details exactly how and when that transformation took place over the early years.
You know, that is the story as it unfolds. You know, the Facebook didn't have to be the way it is now. There were a number of these changes, and some of them, as you describe, were pretty clear-cut decisions that Zuckerberg had to make between the light side and the dark side, let's say. And people around him were saying, no, don't do this. This is a bad mistake, or this is wrong in some cases. And he felt, well, we could correct later on. Let's just go for this side. We're going to grow better this side if we make this decision. And if there's a privacy issue, we'll fix it later. And when he did get caught on privacy issues, he would apologize and go on. Not because he's like this mustache twirling guy, but he felt, well, in the larger sense, we're a good company. And so our sub goals justify the big goal, even if the sub goals wind up getting into dicey areas. And, you know, you've made your decision, Mark, about where, you know, the value of that mode of thinking. But I felt it's useful to see that thought process and the way it worked and how it unfolded piece by piece. And it comes out to be an important story, not only of Facebook, but about the whole arc of technology and how good intentions sometimes went awry, and a story in a larger sense about things like that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the key questions that people have about Facebook and Zuckerberg. To suggest that he's a cartoonish mustache twirler, is he a cartoon villain? Is he pure evil? I think that's the wrong question. Because if the answer is no, he's not a cartoon villain, I don't think it's fair to then say, oh, well, then he must be just a lovable rascal who got in over his head and no one could have foretold that this would happen. Because there's a defense that Facebook uses that a lot of Silicon Valley boosters use, which is that technology is neutral, and therefore the owners and developers of technology are themselves completely neutral. And if something bad happens, it's because of bad people out there. It's not the techies' fault. Maybe they got in a little over their head. And I disagree with that perspective. Reading the stories in your book, Stephen, strengthens my position that no, Zuck, while he's not a cartoonish villain, has consistently made unethical decisions, unethical at best. I mean, at worst, murderous decisions. One of the stories that helped strengthen my conviction that there's actually an active commitment to wrong decisions there is the story of Brian Acton. Now, I'd heard bits and pieces of the WhatsApp story here and there. I saw a famous quote that Brian Acton made in the press a couple of years ago. So I appreciated you telling the full story in the book, because you do dive into the stories of the WhatsApp acquisition as well as the Instagram acquisition, the failed attempt at a Snapchat acquisition. Anyway, Brian Acton and a partner had formed WhatsApp with the explicit mission of not delivering ads to their users. And they make that promise to their users. And then you fast forward to the end, they get paid billions of dollars to sell WhatsApp to Facebook. And Zuck, almost immediately after he completes the acquisition, begins to bring ads to those users. And Brian Acton then departs Facebook and he goes and starts Signal, which is an app that more closely resembles what he wanted WhatsApp to be originally. And of course, there are no ads on Signal. And he has said publicly, and I learned this through your book, that billionaire Brian Acton feels that he is doing penance. That's his word, penance, for making so much money from Mark Zuckerberg that he apparently feels guilty about it and wants to do something. And he's not the only one. You go over several stories of executives who quit or leave Facebook in disgust and say, this guy Zuckerberg is making the wrong decisions. In other words, if we just go on the words of people who've worked with him and have helped build this toxic company to the point that it is today, just listening to the people themselves, you get a very negative impression of the values and decision-making that go on at Facebook.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned Ackman. I thought you were going to go somewhere else with him. What I try to do, and the reason why it's so good to get a lot of pages to be able to discuss this, is that life is kind of nuanced. So Acton, to me, is largely a sympathetic character. You hear his story about he got backed into a corner by Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg turned out to be a brilliant, you know, kind of ruthless negotiator when he tries to buy these companies. He failed with Evan Spiegel and Snapchat, but succeeded with Instagram and WhatsApp. He gave them so much money, they couldn't possibly turn them down. It was the offer you could not refuse. And, you know, and you're sympathetic to Acton when you hear about this, though, how, as I said to him, even in the end of our interview, we had this long multi-hour interview. You know, like I said, well, you do have like $3 billion. You know, things aren't that bad, Brian.
And that was Stephen Levy talking about his interview with Brian Acton, the co-founder of WhatsApp, who sold the app to Mark Zuckerberg and then apparently felt guilt around that to the degree that he then founded Signal, which is now a messaging service that I use and I recommend widely to people. So that was Tectonic episode 135 from May 25, 2020. If you're just tuning in, by the way, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, and we're about halfway through the show. We are marking a milestone on today's show. It is episode 400 of Tectonic. That is 400 shows that I've hosted along the way since the show started in September of 2017. And what I'm doing is I'm playing some excerpts of interviews from each of the hundreds, and ones under 100, and then in the hundreds, the 200s, and the 300s. And we are now at the episode numbered 200 to begin the back half of our excerpts. This is a show from October 25, 2021. And this was an interview with the directors of a documentary that had just come out called Red Heaven, the directors Lauren DeFilippo and Catherine Gorringe. I found this to be a really interesting documentary. It's about a group of scientists who go into a kind of sealed-off biodome located in Hawaii in this very spare, almost Martian environment in order to simulate what it would be like to live and do research long-term on the planet Mars. And so, of course, one of the questions that comes up in the documentary is, why Mars? And I ask both of the directors what their answer is. And I want to play you Catherine's answer. This, again, is Catherine Gorringe, one of the two directors of the documentary Red Heaven. Do you feel excited and enthusiastic that we'll mount a Mars mission and go explore a new world? Or are you a little doubtful, saying, we have a pretty good planet already, and maybe we should be focusing our efforts on cleaning up the mess we've made here?
What really got me in the process of making this film is that there is a sector of the Humans to Mars community that is all about like planting a flag and space tourism that just seems completely absurd in this day and age and an absolute waste of resources. But the people that we got to know who run this experiment and the people in the experiment were real scientists. And that's not what they were interested in. They were interested in scientific discovery. And Dr. Kim Binstead, who runs the experiment, who is at the University of Hawaii, one of the first things she told us was that we need to send humans to Mars because humans are just so much better at doing research than robots. And we could send robots, but for how long it takes to create the robot, get it to Mars, have it land, have it pick up a sample. It's like by that time you have new questions that you wish the robot was capable of answering. And if you just send a human being, they're able to roll with the punches and you are able to communicate with them and they're able to just like lift up a rock. If you want a robot that's capable of lifting up a rock, you had to have thought about that 10 years before when you were building it the first time. And so that's really how they were thinking about it. And that's how Christiana and Cyprian and Tristan and Carmel and all these people in our film were thinking about it, that if we can get a human being on another planet in our solar system, the amount that we could discover about our own planet, about how our solar system works, about the origins of the universe is untold. And that's, you know, Lauren and I don't come from a science background, so that's not something we were initially that interested in the film. We were interested in these larger philosophical questions about human capacity and human adaptability. But that's something that really had an impact on us.
And again, that was Catherine Gorringe, co-director of the documentary film Red Heaven, speaking with me on the October 25, 2021 episode of Tectonic. And I'm not sure where Red Heaven is available or streaming these days, but if you're interested in Mars, I'd recommend it. It's a really interesting look at some very earnest scientists who believe, as you heard Catherine saying, believe in the possibilities of sending humans to Mars. And I'll note that this is totally different from the messaging that we get from the oligarchs. I'm specifically talking about Elon Musk, but I guess he's not alone. But Musk will often say that he's going to bring us to Mars and he's going to start this Mars colony and everything. And it all comes out as a self-aggrandizing venture as opposed to really a legitimate scientific exploration. And here you have scientists talking about Mars from a different angle because they're genuinely interested in it. I also like the contrast between humans and robots that gives a different angle onto that conversation, that they're saying, hey, we actually need humans because a human can be adaptable and pick up that rock, as Catherine said. So better to send humans than robots. I should have said before, if you want links to any of these shows that I'm talking about, you can find them on the episode page at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Let's move on to the next episode. This is going to be episode 268 from April 17, 2023. My guest was Meredith Broussard, author of the book More Than a Glitch, Confronting Race, Gender, and Ability Bias in Tech. This was the second time that Meredith Broussard had been on the show. Previously, she had talked about her earlier book, Artificial Unintelligence. But since we're here in the 200s of the episodes of Tectonic, I thought this would be a good one to bring up. So Broussard is going to talk about how the discriminatory nature of algorithms, for example, in mortgage approval, are really baked into the system. It's to the point of her book, it's more than just a one-off glitch in the code. And we're going to hear her describe what that means. So again, from April 17, 2023, episode 268, my interview excerpt with Meredith Broussard. You're making the point that computers are just they start as a reflection of the world they inhabit. I mean, if someone believes that racism, sexism, and ableism don't exist in the world, then there's not much more to say. But if people can agree that those isms do exist, the algorithms, the platforms, the systems start by reflecting those, and they even can work to amplify those problems.
A really good example of this is mortgage approval algorithms. So the markup reported on mortgage approval algorithms a couple of years ago, what they found was that automated mortgage approval algorithms are 40 to 80% more likely to deny borrowers of color versus their white counterparts. And of course, homeownership is a major way of building generational wealth, right? So why are the mortgage approval algorithms discriminating? Well, it's not because the developers set out to write a racist algorithm. What happened is the algorithms are constructed the way that all machine learning algorithms are constructed. People took a bunch of data, historical data, fed it into the computer and said, computer, make me a model. The computer said, okay. And it made a model, machine learning model, that showed the mathematical patterns in the data. And then that model was what was used to predict who was going to be a good credit risk for a mortgage in the future, right? And so this is a totally legitimate data science method. But what those data scientists were not taking into account was the sociological factors embedded in that data, the history of financial discrimination in lending in the United States, the history of residential segregation in the United States. And all of these, frankly, shameful practices are embedded in the historical data. And so they're reproduced in the mortgage approval algorithms, and that's why we see bias in the algorithms. So there's not really a way to get around this. There isn't such a thing as unbiased historical data about who has been given mortgages in the United States in the past.
Yeah, and to your larger point in the book, this is not something that can be brought up in a code review and fixed by changing a couple lines of code. I mean, that's simply not possible to fix this as though it was a bug. As you say, it's more than a glitch. Another example that you wrote a whole chapter on that I liked a lot was facial recognition. And I agree with you. I think it should be banned, just banned. But let's back up for a second. You tell the story of Robert Williams in Detroit, which I covered, I think, the week after this all went down in Detroit.
Ooh.
But can you, for listeners who weren't listening a few years ago when that all happened, the police were looking for someone who had stolen some goods from a Shinola store in downtown Detroit. They had a little bit of security cam footage, and they run it through their facial recognition system, and it says, well, there's a chance it's a gentleman named Robert Williams. And so can you fill in the story from there? What happened? And obviously it was false. This was a totally inaccurate outcome. What happened to Robert Williams?
Well, he was wrongfully arrested. He was wrongfully detained because of a facial recognition match that was inaccurate. And facial recognition systems, we know from the Gender Shades paper and from the NIST study, we know that these systems are better at recognizing light skin than dark skin. They're better at recognizing men than recognizing women. Trans and non-binary folks are generally excluded from these systems entirely. And so who's affected by poor facial recognition matches in policing? Well, it's people with darker skin. It's communities who are already over-policed. You know, one of the things that data scientists often say when you bring up facial recognition is they say, well, you know, if the problem was that the training data didn't have enough people of different skin types and different skin shades, then maybe we'll just, you know, increase the diversity in the training data. We'll make it more accurate. And that would absolutely work to make facial recognition more accurate. But an abolitionist view of the situation would say, listen, let's just not use facial recognition in policing at all, because it is disproportionately weaponized against communities of color.
And that again was Meredith Broussard talking with me in April of 2023. She's the author of More Than a Glitch, Confronting Race, Gender, and Ability Bias in Tech. And that was one of the early conversations on facial rec on the show, and there have been so many more since then. And unfortunately, that technology has not been banned. It has just proliferated more and more. Let's move on to episode 300. This is from January 8, 2024. My guest was Jason Kebler from 404 Media, talking about a really interesting story he wrote about on cameras from a banned Chinese company being bought by a company in New Jersey with COVID funds. It was pretty wild. Let's hear how he puts it. We should say something about the cameras themselves. You mentioned the ALPRs, the automated license plate readers. These are cameras that, as you said, monitor the license plate of every car driving past. You know, it's set up on the side of the road or above a road. And so it just documents who passes by and feeds it into some fusion center for the purposes of police surveillance, surveilling everyone who drives past. Your article mentions that these cameras were intended to integrate with other surveillance systems. You write, a document about its deal with the township of West Orange advertises that Pacatalk systems are, quote, capable of automated surveillance, and notes that they integrate with other surveillance services such as gunshot detection by ShotSpotter, which I know has its own issues and own controversies, which I think I've covered on past shows. In other words, this is not simply a question of who's going to be supplying the ALPRs to sit on the Garden State Parkway. It's a profusion of surveillance systems, some of which were being supplied by banned Chinese vendors. But it, for me, raised a question in my mind. I wonder how many New Jersey residents understand the scale and the depth of the surveillance infrastructure that's being built up in their state all around them day by day.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point. And we did mention sort of the ALPR cameras, but Pacatalk is selling a bigger automated surveillance system to a lot of these cities. It's not just the license plate scanning cameras. It's also what they're calling AI cameras, which, you know, a lot of companies are just putting the term AI to catch a buzz, perhaps. But what they profess to do is, you know, if they detect some sort of anomaly, you can go back and like search through the footage very quickly. The sort of ShotSpotter integration, as you mentioned, ShotSpotter is a gunshot detection microphones that are in many cities. What Pacatalk was saying is that if ShotSpotter detected a gunshot, you know, the cameras would start filming things like that. A lot of these cameras say that they have, you know, either object detection or facial recognition. And yeah, there's been a huge proliferation over the last few years, not just in New Jersey, of course, but all over the country. And even small police departments and small communities now have surveillance cameras and surveillance technology that was, you know, maybe military grade just a few years ago.
And that again was Jason Kebler from 404 Media from January 8, 2024, talking about his article. I just love this headline. New Jersey used COVID relief funds to buy banned Chinese surveillance cameras. Let's move on now to the final excerpt that I wanted to play for you on this episode 400 of Tectonic. This comes from episode 322 from June 24, 2024. My guest was Byron Tao, author of a book called Means of Control. And here you're going to hear us talking about a government official's denial from a few years ago that the government is surveilling U.S. citizens. Byron Tao did a great job of talking about the nascent surveillance state that has really grown since then. But let's go ahead and listen to this excerpt with Byron Tao from June 2024. A few months before Snowden, there is this Senate committee hearing in which the Director of National Intelligence, a guy named James Clapper, is questioned by Senator Ron Wyden. And he's being questioned about the NSA's surveillance of Americans. And what I'd like to do, Byron, is I just want to read a little excerpt of your book because I thought you expressed this moment very well. Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? Asked Senator Ron Wyden. No, sir, replied Clapper. It does not? Wyden said, eyebrows arched in a surprised tone bordering on incredulous. Not wittingly, Clapper said. This entire scene was kabuki theater. Clapper knew the answer was yes. Wyden knew the answer was yes. And neither was allowed to say it in a public hearing. Months later, Edward Snowden would reveal that the NSA had a program that collected all the phone records of every American. I thought this was really important in that Clapper is questioned directly about surveillance. He denies it and then later gives what I feel like was a pretty flimsy justification. He said, no, I wasn't lying. It's that surveillance isn't the harvesting or storage of data. It's the moment the data is accessed when the government is actually looking for someone, which is sort of a strange redefinition of surveillance.
Yeah, and that's typical of how intelligence community officials and people inside government talk about some of these programs, that the way that they think of them and describe them, the definition that Clapper was using of surveillance is a very different one than the average person on the street would use, right? If you ask the average American if the NSA vacuuming up every single phone call record is a form of surveillance, I think they would say yes. But if you ask the NSA's lawyers, based on some interpretations of various laws and their own, their own way of interpreting their authorities and their ability to do things, they'd say, well, it's not surveillance unless we look at it. And that's something that I saw time and time again in my research, that governments have their own way of talking about things, have their own vocabulary, and that vocabulary often doesn't match up with the expectation of the average citizen. And that's what I thought was so interesting about this topic, that, you know, when you look at all the data that's collected by corporations or by governments, they're talking about data in ways that are different than the average person thinks about data and their own information, the information they give to these entities. And I thought the disconnect was very important to explain in detail.
And that again was Byron Tao, author of the book, Means of Control, How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. And that brings us to the end of all 8 excerpts I wanted to play for you today. This has been the 400th episode of Tectonic, and I just want to say thanks for all the support I've gotten from WFMU and you, the listeners, for 8.5 years now to help me have the energy to keep going. And I'm looking forward to bringing you more episodes with these themes and others. Again, if you want to find links to today's episodes that were excerpted, go to the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. And until next time, friends, you know exactly what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. And I'm really looking forward to our fundraising marathon starting next week with my co-host, station manager Ken. Stay tuned for Dave Mandel. And to go out today, I'm really excited to play this track. It's a single by the artist Night Night called Total Control.
On a warehouse fire. Greetings and good evening. And I'm not going to make a big fuss about the weather here. I'm just going to say that I fought the PATH train and I won. The PATH train, which brings people to Jersey City here, is a delicate little flower and stops working, you know, stops running at the tiniest provocation. But I made it, and I'm very happy to be here, and I would not miss it for the world. I really, really am glad I was able to get down here in person to WFMU and bring you tonight's show. So thanks for listening to the first 40 seconds, and I have lots of good music for you tonight. This show, of course, is called It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. And we're going to start the show. I have a bunch of new things today, but I'm going to start with something that is older. I'm going to play something from Gong. Gong, of course, French weirdo hippie prog band. And I'm going to play something from a later period Gong. There are kind of, you might say, two periods of the band Gong. The group, of course, was formed by David Allen, the brilliant Australian hippie pothead. But at some point, he left the group, and the group went into a more blatantly jazz, or let's say fusion-y direction, and it was kind of led, I guess, by a guy named Pierre Morlin, who was a played xylophone, played percussion, mainly xylophone. And in fact, at a certain point, due to whatever legal problems that I don't want to know about, the band actually had to change its name to Pierre Morlin's Gong. But at this point, they were still called Gong, but definitely the jazzier version of the group. We're going to hear a track from the album called Shamal, released in 1976. And this is going to be a track called Chandra from Gong. We'll be right back.
just another fish in the sea, yeah. Did you get it? Start to see.